Good afternoon, everyone. It is Tuesday, March 14th, and you are listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. CITR is a campus and community radio station based on UBC's Point Grey campus. We're located on the unceded, ancestral, and traditional territories of the Musqueam people. Every Tuesday at noon, we broadcast our news show, Against the Current, which we then rebroadcast every Saturday at noon. My name is Jasmine, I'm the News Collective Lead, and I'll be your host for today's episode, and we've got some pretty exciting stuff for you planned this week. We are going to start off with a segment about single-use plastics, then we'll launch into an interview with Lucy Segu, a Black feminist graduate student here at UBC, and then end off with an interview with Esme Decker, the representative of Remy the Rat and winner of this year's AMS presidential elections. I will now hand it over to Theo to talk about single-use plastics here at UBC.
Hello, and welcome to Fees Get Degrees, where we'll be talking about the coffee cup charge at UBC and how it might be serving sustainability or secretly eating away at your savings. Vancouver just dropped a similar charge. Should UBC follow suit, or should the fee be even higher? Grab your reusable cup or recorder and join Milada Zifitsky and Cassidy Holmes to learn more over your favorite beverage.
Hey, Milada.
Hey, Cassidy. So, what do you usually get at a cafe?
I usually get a chai latte with oat milk. How about you?
Well, with how things have been expensive on campus, I've been just making cold brew at home. How much would you say you spend weekly on drinks?
I'd say I spend like $18 a week. But it seems like one of those dollars seems to be going towards the cups rather than the drink.
Oh, you're talking about the single-use cup fee.
Yeah. At the start of last year, UBC started their zero-waste foodware strategy that charges fees for single-use items on campus. The strategy is supposed to encourage the use of reusable food and beverage containers with fees for single-use items, so you're getting charged 25 cents for single-use cups, 15 cents for paper bags, and 50 cents for food containers. The fee is essentially meant to dissuade people on campus from reaching for a single-use option.
The fee's been around for just over a year now, but how do students and faculty feel about it? And is it really making a difference?
Dr. Anubhav Pratap Singh is an assistant professor with the Faculty of Land and Food Systems specializing in the area of processing.
If I have to summarize it in one sentence, I think it is a step in the positive direction. Right now, we are facing a big problems which has been created within the last 50 years by the overuse of plastics. So the strategy here is to eliminate as much as possible food and foodware related wastes. And so this is a step in that direction.
Anu explained how the fee is supposed to work in deterring people from using single-use cups and containers.
I think it's not about the one-time 25 cents that they have to pay. Ultimately, you have to pay that 25 cents two times a day if you drink 2 cups of coffee. And over time, that will add up. And this will basically inspire the customers to keep that coffee cup within their car holder all the time so that they can use them. This is a societal mindset which is needed.
We also spoke to Esme Decker, the new AMS president. They're doing a minor in environment and society and completing a work learn at UBC's Climate Hub. They also support the fee, specifically the psychology behind making students think twice about what they're purchasing. Here's Esme.
I would say I'm on the side of really thinking about the psychology of the fee and how that is encouraging people to rethink whether they're going to just simply take a free item that ends up in the landfill or not.
We spoke to some students on campus to see if the fee is doing what Anu and Esme are hoping it will, to deter students from buying single-use items.
So how do you feel about paying 25 cents for every container or cup that you buy on campus?
I feel it's an unnecessary fee. Like when I have classes, I just need to pick something and go. So most of the time I have to buy a container. And it's an added load on top of, I think, everything that I already have to pay for on campus.
I really don't think that much about, like, you know, I'm paying 25 cents for the container. But I just feel like the fact that they're charging, it may, you know, some people may not, like, you know, refuse to buy and maybe use it actually to, like, bring their own stuff. So I feel for the environment, it may be a good initiative. But, like, I feel no one really thinks that much regarding it.
In most cases, if the fee isn't too much, I'll be like, it's okay. Like another 50 cents, 25 cents, it's okay.
Yeah, I'd say it depends on the amount of the fee. Like if it's more small, it doesn't really matter if I'm already spending $5. But if I'm spending less and it's higher, then I'm probably, it does deter me from doing it. Yeah.
Do you think it's an effective strategy for sustainability initiatives?
No. The fee is not high enough for it to be an effective strategy, and it's low enough that I buy it anyways.
I think more could probably be done. I don't know if this is like the best way because students, I guess, are still paying for that fee. Maybe upping the price, but again, that's like, I don't want to be doing that either. Like, I don't want to be paying that.
I wouldn't say it's that effective, especially like most people don't even know there's a problem and they don't know they're paying that amount. And so it doesn't really matter at that point anyways.
Had you ever noticed it before?
No, there should be a bigger sign that says it is like if they're really trying to deter students, they should say that there's a fee, right? But like honestly, I didn't even know until just now. Thinking about all the times I bought this stuff, it feels like I'm slowly getting robbed.
So, some students on campus either don't care or they don't even know about it. What do you think about that? Is it being advertised enough?
Esme brings this point up too, that some students don't even know about the fee. When we spoke with them, they said that if employees were to ask you with every purchase if you're okay with paying the fee, it might be more effective.
I think it's important to like have training for employees saying like, yeah, and just let's just make sure to try to make this fee as effective as possible by like letting customers know, which is at least what I am supposed to do at the ice cream store that I work at. If I'm selling a coffee, I'll say, and is this for here or to go? And if it's to go, it's like, okay, I'll just letting you know that there's this much of a fee on this cup. So that they're aware of that. And then they can kind of think about if they want to be paying that fee perpetually in the future.
So another point of controversy surrounding these fees is that there's no universal guideline for how the fees are being collected or how any revenue collected is being used. And just recently, it's been discovered that the AMS has been using that money to purchase even more single-use items, rather than putting it towards sustainability or food insecurity on campus. After being made aware of this discrepancy, the AMS now said it will donate any money collected to the AMS Food Bank.
Ideally, the fees would be used towards sustainable solutions. I guess the complexity of the issue is, you know, the operating costs for these businesses on campus. Are they all operating under the same conditions?
That was Dr. Ricky Yada, the dean of the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, speaking about the revenue collection of the fee.
Here's Esme on the same thing.
Yeah, I think it is important to consider where that revenue is going and make sure that it is basically like being reinvested in the purpose that it is trying to serve, which is climate action.
So, final thoughts. So what? Is it effective? Is it doing what it was intended to do? Could it be even more effective?
Most students didn't really think twice about paying for it, and a few said if the fee was higher, it would be more of a deterrent. It doesn't seem like it's a top priority for students. Should campus drop the fee just like Vancouver did, or should we increase it?
It definitely makes me think more about going to coffee shops and what that means for sustainability in my wallet next time I find myself a cup of chai.
All right, thank you folks for listening, and make sure to stay tuned after our break for an interview with Lucy Segu, a Black feminist scholar and graduate student here at the UBC Department of Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice.
Okay, let's see here. Blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both. Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. And for our second segment for today's episode, we chatted with Lucy Segu, a Black feminist scholar and graduate student here at UBC's Social Justice Institute, about her research and about the journey that she's taken to get here. Okay, can you start by introducing yourself for me, please?
Yes, my name is Lucy B. Segu. I'm a first generation Haitian American, born and raised in Miami, which is the ancestral home of the Tequesta First Nations and the traditional lands of the Seminole and Miccosukee folks. So that is me.
Okay, thank you so much. And can you tell me a bit more about your research here at UBC as part of the Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice Institute?
Yes, so I have a long history of being an activist, being a social worker. And so I've, you know, been working at those various intersections from a community standpoint with young people as well as adults. And when I came to UBC, I was looking for an opportunity to marry all of the things that I was interested in, all of the things that I was already working towards. So the thing that led me to social justice, that led me to activism, that led me to become a social worker was Black women's literature. So when I was an undergrad at Florida Memorial University, which is a historical Black college in Miami, that's where I was introduced to Black women writers. And by being introduced to Black women writers, I was introduced to a world of knowledge and philosophers thinking about how Black women were writing about and thinking about the interiority of Black people, and especially Black women. That was great. That was fascinating to me. And so through reading Black women writers, I found Black feminists, Black feminism. And that was just, that blew my mind, that changed my life for the better. And that just put me on a completely different trajectory. And so right now, I like to liken myself as a Black feminist emerging scholar, Black digital Black feminist creative that's really trying to, just operationalize Black feminism and studying it in that regard. So I'm really into digital Black feminism. I'm really into social justice because I have an activist social work background. And so I bring all of those together, but the overarching umbrella that holds these things is Black feminism, because I do everything from a Black feminist standpoint. So to me, I'm a practitioner. It's not just theory, it's about praxis. So that is what my research is about the praxis of Black feminism.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for such an insightful answer. And I have a couple of follow-up questions about what you've just told me. The first being, what have been, you've talked about Black women writers and Black women literature. What writers have shaped your research and your understanding of Black feminism the most? And are there any particular literary works that you've really been gravitating towards to recenter and reground yourself?
Yeah, so there are so many. But when immediately the one that comes up for me is Toni Morrison. Picking up Toni Morrison, picking up her work, and seeing how she would build these worlds where Black people were the center. There were no margin in Toni Morrison's world. Black people were the center, and Black women were, like, we were the center of that center, right? So thinking about that, in a book that I come back to a lot is Sula, a book that is all about Black women, friendship, and platonic love. And that is a book that I find that grounds me. And when I think about Beloved, a book she wrote about an enslaved woman making a really radical, bold choice around parenting and motherhood. So I think about that. So definitely the Black feminists, when I think about the Black feminists who really anchor me, who I consider like my North Stars, I want to say my big three are Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, and Harriet Tubman. So I go back to these three figures over and over again, especially Auntie Audre Lorde, because this is someone who was battling breast cancer, who this is from her writings and teachings that we get self-care that has been completely and utterly like whitewashed, disrespected, and like stretched out of form. But this woman was constantly talking about how do we engage with each other across differences without not creating hierarchies. And that is just something I come back to over and over and over again in my own life, trying not to reproduce white supremacy, trying not to reproduce the body hierarchy. And then Bell Hooks is, she's that girl. Like, Bell Hooks really made it okay to be a smart, nerdy Black girl who was deeply interested in philosophy, but wasn't talking about philosophy in a white Western male kind of a way. And so when I think about Bell Hooks is just someone who is very, very important to my understanding of myself as a Black feminist. And of course, Harriet Tubman, the ultimate ancestor, who was born in enslavement, but who did not believe the lies that the enslavers were trying to tell her about herself. She never saw herself as property. She was very keenly aware with her sovereignty. So she loved herself so much, and she believed in herself so much that she stole herself away from slavery. She stole herself and she went north and traveled to Canada to free herself, right? But then she realized she did the ultimate thing that Black feminism teaches us to do, that we understand that freedom, consciousness tastes better. It's sweeter with other people. And so what does she do? She goes back to go help save other people and help them get free. And then she's so bold and she's so beautiful in terms of, like, when people were not sure that they wanted to go forward and continue on this fugitive situation, like, she had a gun to their back, like, baby, it's freedom or nothing, because you're not going to risk everybody else's freedom because you're scared to go forward and move forward. And so for me, that is definitely an impulse. Those three people, that fugitivity, because I like to think that as a public scholar, that's what my work attempts to do. Is like, how do I steal knowledge from the academy and bring it back to my people, bring it back to my homies, bring it back to my communities, where I know these tools, these interventions can be put into immediate use. And so these three people, these three, you know, feminist ancestors, feminist aunties, ancestral mentors definitely are pillars of my sociopolitical understanding and how I do things. And I will never not be not citing them. These are the philosophers, these are the thinkers, these are the people I come back to.
Thank you for such a powerful description of how they've impacted your life and your thinking. Sula is actually at the top of my own personal TBR, and I have a copy of All About Love somewhere in my room. And it's been a really prominent influence on kind of my developing research interests right now. And just to kind of follow up with a couple of the other things you've said, you've mentioned that it's helped you become a public scholar, and I would love to know a bit more about what that means for you, and also about what it means to be a Black feminist public scholar as well.
Yeah. So how would I start this? So when I entered into my program to pursue a PhD program, PhD degree, I always knew that I don't want to be a tenured professor. I don't want to go on that particular academic hustle and track, right? And so to me, it's always just like, I want to be a community scholar. I want to just take this stuff and work with nonprofits and do other things. And so I think I'm pretty resolved in that, although I will say, like, I am definitely interested in being a visiting scholar, and kind of like having one foot in the academy, one foot out. But at the same time, I feel like the highest manifestation of my purpose and how I could be of service to my people might not be to be completely housed in the academy. So I always came in with the understanding that we're gonna get this, we're gonna do this work, we're gonna hide out here for a little bit, we're gonna learn some things, and we're gonna go back to our people. And that's essentially what I've been doing. Now, the interesting thing is, while being a PhD student, I actually did start a business, the Social Justice Doula, which is completely rooted in my Black feminist practice. And my dissertation is about my Black feminist practice, which is also my business, the Social Justice Doula, in which I do anti-racist education with individuals as well as nonprofits. So I like to say that I accompany people in their process of operationalizing an anti-racist feminist ethic at work, in their relationships. I've worked with all sorts of people, creative, parents, executive directors, you name it, who want to know how to operationalize their ethics, right? And I do all of that from a Black feminist lens. And so for me, I've been thinking about, like, you know, we know a lot about what Black feminists are, just, you know, feminist scholars, what they think about this, what they think about that, but we know very little about how did they live their life, that daily practice of living, how did they do that? And so I'm really interested in that. So my public scholarship is about, of course, writing, theorizing from a Black feminist standpoint, introducing all sorts of people to Black feminism and letting them know, like, they can really incorporate Black feminism in their own gender liberation politic. Like, yes, you can't call yourself a Black feminist if you ain't Black, but that doesn't mean you cannot bring Black feminism into your understanding. Because I like to tell people, my Black feminism, yes, it's rooted in a long tradition of Black feminist thinkers, and it is highly informed and inspired by indigenous feminisms, as well as woman of color feminism. And so for me, I'm thinking about, how does one live a life that is in service to, that espouses feminism on every level, on a theoretical level, on a practical level, within liminal spaces, in all sorts of relations. And so that to me is like, I don't know, to me, life is where I do my scholarship, where life is where I do my teaching. So I do a lot of stuff for the public. Like I have public seminars where I recreate grad school level seminars for everyday people talking about really heady theoretical ideas, because these people may never go off to, to grad school or whatever, but grad school can come to them. Like theory doesn't only live in the academy, and that's what my work really tries to do. Like how do we, again, going back to, I'm stealing this stuff, bringing it here, all in service. And also when it comes to public scholars, you know, I can't front, nobody does it better than Black feminists, right? When you think about the scholars that people know and who they're not even in the academy, a lot of people know, like, of course people know Dr. Cornel West, people might know Brittany Cooper, people know Melissa Harris Perry. These people might be more famous in the United States of America. But when we think about public scholars, it's typically Black scholars, is overwhelmingly Black feminists, because Black feminists, although we're getting all this fancy education, we are still connected to our people and to our homies, and we want to stay connected to them. So we have to figure out ways how to explain to our people what we do and for what purpose and benefit. So for me, that's what I want to do. I want to demystify the academy. I want to demystify theory. And I want to show my people that they are the original theorists. It's them who do the thing. It's Black feminists out here in the world who would never call themselves Black feminists. They're the ones who are doing it and living it and practicing it. And then people go off into the academy and write about what they did. So it comes first and foremost from that organic space. So I'm trying to stand in this liminal space of pulling on the practice, pulling on the theory to be about that practice. So that is a long way of explaining my public scholarship. And again, I'm a digital Black feminist, so a lot of stuff I do is around creating media that raises consciousness, that plants seeds of consciousness so that people can rise up. Because there's a lot of talk about how people get red-pilled on the internet, which is true. People get radicalized, people fall into these very weird things, but people are also getting on the opposite side, getting radicalized in a leftist progressive way. And I like to liken myself to, like, you know, the social justice Morpheus. Like I'm offering you a different way to, like, to quote unquote wake up, even though we know that racist, xenophobic, violent, particularly white males, have taken the concept of waking up and wokeness and have destroyed it. But there is a waking up that we need to do if we're gonna save ourselves from the belly of the beast and do something different. So I don't know if all of that makes sense, but that's what the world is my classroom. I have no interest in being in the academy, and I'm not, you know, it's not to create a hierarchy of like, I'm doing it better, they're doing it different. It's just that, you know, I'm a street scholar. I'd rather be with the people on the street and making the thing more real in that and more real in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I think that absolutely made sense, and it's definitely starting to influence the way I am viewing how I might want to engage with my own community as well as an emerging scholar myself, hopefully. And maybe to tie everything together, I kind of wanted to backtrack a little bit and ask you what is your understanding of the core principles of Black feminism and the different ways that you operationalize it in your own life.
Yeah, so one of the core principles of Black feminist thought, as told to us by Patricia Hill Collins, the Black feminist scholar who wrote the text on Black feminist thought, is like, reclaiming subjugated knowledges, right? That Black women, because we were stolen and trafficked to the Americas, we've had to think about gender, we've had to think about race, we've had to think about all of these different things from a different perspective, and we have knowledge. And so we like to talk about the margins, but people tend to forget, like, there's a lot of rich understanding and nuance and philosophy and philosophizing and intellectualizing that's happening on the margin. And Black feminism encourages us to reclaim, to understand that from where I stand, from where I sit, I have something to say and I have knowledge that needs to be put out in the world. And that's one of my most favorite tenets of Black feminism, because it's just like, it's all about reclaiming subjugated knowledges, right? Reclaiming subjugated knowledges around queerness, around transness, around Blackness, around what does it mean to be a Black woman, but you're not yet kind of legible to white colonial understandings of gender, but you're legible to yourself, you're legible to your people. So thinking about that, and also because, you know, this is from a North American standpoint, like Black feminism is also comes out of deeply an American U.S. on the other side of Turtle Island, a U.S. understanding of, like, because we were stolen and trafficked and dispersed, that the way Black people, Black Americans experience chattel slavery on these lands, and I say these lands because I'm in Miami, deeply shaped our politics, deeply shaped our understanding, which reminds us of what our indigenous kin remind us, is that land is pedagogy, is methodology. Land has something to teach us and to tell us, and the lands on which your people were born and you were born, the lands that raised you, start to shape you. And it is out of that that Black feminism comes out of, because when the first enslaved Black folks arrived here in the United States in 1619, stuff got real, really quick and people had to understand. So those are, thinking about those things, those are the core tenets and of that. And what was their other question that you asked? Core tenets of Black feminism and what else?
And how do you operationalize Black feminism in your own life?
Ooh, yes. So in my own life, I don't think I do anything that's outside of the purview of Black feminism, really. You know, like I'm running my business. From that regard, like I'm a first generation Haitian American, thinking about how do I reclaim the subjugated knowledge of my people being Haitian, the revolution, thinking about my own understanding of my queerness and my gender and all the kind of things. So I am constantly in this struggle, this not even struggle, but in conversation with myself to reclaim. And I am constantly thinking about the lands and how those lands inform me. When I was the 3 years that I lived in Vancouver, that deeply politicized me in a way that I didn't quite think it would. I had a lot of problems within the city because it's less than 1% Black. It was really lonely. It was like, couldn't even buy decent hair care products there. So I've never experienced Blackness being that invisibilized in that regard. You know, thank goodness, because, you know, I'm surrounded by Blackness and Black people all the time. However, being on those land, being in Vancouver, listening, reading Indigenous scholars, listening to Indigenous elders, and understanding like how that lane shaped and kind of like, if my Black, it just made allow my Black feminism to go to like newer heights. And I had a new appreciation for what land is, what land does, and how land informs us. And land became more prominent in my politics. And so, yeah, so I'm never not operationalizing my feminist values and pulling from the different feminist disciplines that inform me, because I'm very serious that I want to live a life that is in service to social justice. So I take seriously the power dynamic that's between me and any person that I come in contact with, right? I take seriously of like, am I reproducing the body hierarchy at any moment? Am I giving preferential treatment to this person because they're light skinned and a little cuter than that person, right? Like, feminism has, you know, there's that concept of the feminist killjoy, and it's made for a more ethical, more capacious life, because I am in a more mindful life, because I am trying to practice radical presence in my life so that I can operationalize my gender liberation politic, my anti-racist politic, to operationalize a world in which you know, queerness, transness, non-binariness is at the center. And so that's why for me, I describe feminism as a civic spiritual practice. It helps me think about what kind of citizen that I want to be in the world, within globally, locally, you name it, transnationally. So to me, feminism is the guiding light and the principle. Like, again, it's my civic spiritual practice without not sounding hyperbolic and being culty about it, but in the most ethical way. I found theory to be the most saving, most life-affirming thing that I found. And that theory is feminism, and more specifically, Black feminism. So, like, it informs everything, like who I date, how I date. Like, I'm like, I don't have children, don't plan on it. If I did, it would inform that. I am an auntie, it informs my auntie. Like, this thing is a thing that I am practicing, and hopefully, being ethical about it in my practice.
Mm-hmm. And I love the way that you've been talking about theory. I did a talk a couple of days ago with some former classmates of mine. And one of the things we talked about is actually something that Eternity Martis, who visited our class last year, a Black Canadian writer and scholar, said about theory being this living, breathing organism. And it's such a powerful concept that I really want to delve into in my own life. So I appreciate being able to listen to your thoughts about that. But I also want to keep an eye on the time. I know I said that I don't want to keep you for too long. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to share or comment on before we say goodbye to each other for today?
Yeah, I guess I would continue on your train of thought about theory. We have the opportunity of being educated in a pretty prestigious university, coming in contact with prestigious scholars, and just, you know, getting to do all of this stuff. We can use theory to separate ourselves from our people, or we could use theory to bridge the gap. Like, and unfortunately, the only mode that we see and that we're very well versed in is theory separating us from our parents, from our immigrant parents, from everybody else. All of a sudden, you know, we can't talk to those people because they haven't read the book, they don't know the language, blah, 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 blah. Or you can use theory to have a better understanding of yourself. And the thing I wanna say, the thing that bell hooks, and I just reread All About Love, the thing that I love so much about what she does with theory is that theory helped me to be like, I don't have to pathologize myself. There is a reason why I feel what I feel, I'm experiencing what I'm experiencing. And it has to do with white supremacy. It has to do with colonialism, has to do with anti-Blackness. It has to do with anti-transness, has to do with all of those things. And so it allowed me to pathologize myself less and to put the burden at the proper place, which is these systems and these structures that, yes, we absorb, yes, that we reenact, but like, I don't have to pathologize myself. And so if the theory matters, if the theory is gonna matter and make this world better, if we're gonna harm ourselves low key to come into grad school, into the academy, there's a way that theory can be healing and beautiful and close the gap and to help us understand ourselves better and pathologize ourselves less. It is not us who is the problem. It is these systems and these structures that need to be dismantled and in some cases completely abolished. That is where I need to busy myself. And so in the age of where we're all treating ourselves like a self-help project and trying to be more effective, maximize our time and our efforts, that's why I think theory can be healing. Because yeah, if I understand anti-Blackness, I understand anti-fatness, I understand trans antagonism and queer antagonism, then I can say, I'm all right, I'm okay, I'm good. I just got these things I need to work through within myself and with other human beings. And I think that has helped me to be more loving and more compassionate to myself, which then reverberates out to others. And, you know, that's not something, you know, people who are studying these fancy things are supposed to say. We're not supposed to act like we're heart-centered people who have feelings and have these kind of stuff. But like, yeah, that is my approach to theory. So there is a kinder, softer, more humane way to be with these liberatory ideas. And I hope more of us than not find that alternative.
And that wraps it up for our interview with Lutzi. Thank you all for listening, and make sure to stay tuned in after the break for our interview with Esme Decker, the representative of Remy the Rat, that is, the winner of this year's AMS presidential elections.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder. But if you take me in your arms, be confident. I can be a
character for our job. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam,
Nisiaya, Anthasia, Tilitin, Homasque Mustail. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CITR's weekly news radio show Against the Current. And for our last segment for today's episode, we chatted with Esme Decker, the representative of Remy the Rat and the winner of this year's AMS presidential elections. Okay, can you start by introducing yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Esme, and I'm a third year student in English honors at UBC. I'm a Japanese Irish settler who grew up here on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territories. And yeah, I am the person who ran as kind of the person at the forefront of a collective of people representing Remy the Rat.
Very nice. Thank you for doing that. And to just backtrack a little bit, can you tell me a little bit about why you ran for the AMS elections last year as a joke candidate as Remy the Rat?
Absolutely. So it was my friend Georgia Yee's idea, but she was actually running seriously for Board of Governors. She'd been on the Board of Governors for a couple years, I think, by then. But she had come by Climate Justice UBC and spoken about the great opportunity of like getting to run AMS elections and how it works and trying to make it a little less intimidating for folks who might want to be interested in it. And afterwards we were talking and I was asking her more questions about running and what it looked like. And I was just second year then, so I wasn't super sure that I wanted to do it then. But she said that a great way into it might be running a joke candidate. And she said that Remy the Rat from Open Kitchen would be a great joke candidate idea. And we could even just focus on bringing up voter turnout again. since the voter turnout had become so low in the year before with the online election. And yeah, there needed to be something to get people interested in the in-person election again.
Absolutely. And can you tell me about how you think the student body reacted to your joke candidacy last year?
Yeah, well, I think it was a little more niche last year because it was like one of seven candidates and there were many different views and perspectives being brought up in last election. But yeah, there was still a lot of support. I think it brought a lot of fun to the election along with the Pan being the other joke candidate. And people also really responded to the platform that the Remy the Rat campaign was bringing forward with also centering again like climate justice, food security, and various justice issues that yeah, me and the team like wanted to bring forward as a vision of what could be possible at the AMS to bring forward a vision of what better world we could work towards. And yeah, it's been really inspiring to see how people responded to that with such positivity and with feelings of being inspired and motivated to get involved this year. And also I saw a lot of people's platforms from serious candidates this year having mentions of many of those things as well. So that was really great to see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing was, yeah, I mean, also just the fact that the Rat was voted in second place last year was amazing to see and not something that I expected at all. So yeah, being able to bring that forward, bring that momentum into this year was really amazing. And I'm, yeah, just so honored to be voted in this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming in second place as a joke candidate, I think, is definitely a testament to the reaction the student body had to your ideas and your platform last year. But to kind of bring it back to the present, can you tell me about why you've decided or why you decided to run as a serious candidate for this year's election?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that like this year I chose to run. This year I ran this year because students asked me to, because students talked with me and showed their enthusiasm about the possibility of Remy running again. They voted online in a little poll on the Remy the Rat Instagram story. And so I felt that motivation and that energy behind the campaign again. And so I decided to bring that forward, but also wanted to take it up a notch because a lot of people kept telling me that I could win. They kept saying to me, you could win this time. I think we have a good chance. And so then seeing like who was running once we got to the all candidates meeting. And yeah, so there was Ben, Coda, me, and then two other joke candidates who I never actually got to meet the people behind those joke candidates. They were kind of just mysterious presences. And then Coda had to drop out. Yeah, just like making that choice for his own well-being. And then one of the joke candidates got disqualified. And then I was like, whoa, okay, this is like kind of a head-to-head race now. Like when I went to the first debate and it was just me and Ben, because ChatGPT can do devices at the debate. Yeah, I was like, I think before then even I was thinking that we would be doing this as a more serious campaign. But yeah, seeing that it was basically a choice between two visions, one kind of representing the status quo of how the AMS operates and one representing yeah, the desire for a change, the shaking up of the status quo. I felt responsibility to provide that choice for people, to give them a candidate that they could vote for if they wanted to see something different in the AMS.
Mm-hmm. And is that why you think students wanted you to run, as you said?
Yeah, I think that there were folks from both, like, people with varying degrees of involvement with the AMS were telling me about this chance to win, this chance to bring something new to the AMS. And I think there are many different motivations for why people voted for the RAT this year. Of course, even when I was canvassing, some people would say, like, oh, I only vote for Joe candidates. And then if they're gonna, if, and I was, I thought that, like, if that's gonna be the reason to get you to vote, like, I just also want to contribute to voter turnout, so that's also part of it. But I also just, like, got so much support for the platform, people being really excited about the genuine energy and hope for a new change in the AMS, and even if it's, that's just, like, in a culture change, even if it, that's just in how students are treated within the AMS, students who work for the AMS, students who are interacting with the AMS through clubs and constituencies, just, like, how we act around the AMS and how the culture is there. I think that's a big part of what people were looking for a change in.
Mm-hmm. And how do you want to change the culture of the AMS as the incoming president?
Yeah. Like, to me, some of these things are so baseline to my personality and vision of life and just principles. But from what I was hearing from different, like, student leaders is that they really want a president or an AMS that communicates clearly, that responds to them, that listens genuinely, and that they get a sense of support from. And yeah, that's all about who I am and who I work with and how I choose to live is all about listening to people's stories and feelings about things and the supports that they need. And I'm very much motivated in life for how I can help people the most in the best way that I can.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any previous experience working for the AMS yourself outside of, like, working with them as a position holder in different student groups, but actually working for the AMS as an organization?
So I tried to apply for the AMS sustainability positions last year. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of surprised that I wasn't hired, because I heard that, just, like, based on how many groups I have been a part of that have to do with sustainability and like, climate justice, and how I had already been on the AMS sustainability subcommittee before in its first year. And the AVP sustainability and the sustainability projects fund folks at the time had really encouraged me to apply. And then, yeah, never got a word back after the interview, though I thought that it had gone quite well. I've heard some things about how that might have come to pass, but I don't know. I probably don't want to share them on air. I think that a big part of how I want to look at the culture of the AMS is also in how we are making sure that everybody who is getting a position at the AMS, working with the AMS, feels like they are in a good place, feels like they're in a good position to do this work, and feels cared for and feels qualified to do the work to care for other students. So I'm looking forward to getting to be part of bringing people into the AMS who might not have gotten the chance to before, for various reasons, and or have felt unheard by the AMS or ignored in one way or another. So I'm hoping to get to do that this year.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think that your involvement with different student groups on campus and different sustainability groups has informed your platform and what you want to achieve as president?
Yeah, my work with different groups at UBC in like various positions, right? Like my work with the UBC Climate Hub, like that group is part of UBC Sustainability, or like Sustainability Hub, which is part of the university, but is mostly student led. So that's an interesting like bridge that we've been at. Climate Justice UBC is like solely students, like independent, like even of the AMS. And so that's where I've gotten to learn a lot about just like from kind of an outside perspective, but a critical perspective, looking at what UBC does, like with its finances, with Board of Governors, like what are different ways of working with the university, getting things done. And then also my perspective from being on the AMS Sustainability Subcommittee and seeing glimpses of how the student union has worked with the university in the past, and like how it has conceived of what sustainability looks like at the AMS. I've been bringing together a lot of different perspectives, I think, of how UBC can work on climate justice, and how different processes like the climate emergency recommendations were, you know, put together by this task force, approved by UBC, and then now being worked on at UBC Sustainability, with the voices of like staff, faculty, and students. Looking at all of these different processes from kind of an outer circle, but digging into documents and digging into what do these things look like, even from a perspective where we're not like invited to the meeting table or whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm. And what are the specific ways that your experiences with different sustainability groups, part of UBC, part of the AMS, and outside of both of these organizations, has affected your platform and like the specific aspects of your platform?
Yeah, thanks. With my platform, like the climate justice section of it is pretty much all informed by students from Climate Justice UBC, students from student perspectives that I heard at the debates, and like just like conversations that I've had with many different students and even alumni, over the past couple of years, and also based on understandings of like say like fossil fuel financing, or like looking at the AMS's connection with RBC and how RBC like finances fossil fuels projects. So with different things in my specific like platform, I've said that